good afternoon, everybody. Yes, that's, who is that? That's William Parker in the background. Start that off early with, At Somewhere There. We're going to tone that down slightly, though. My name is Zeke. I'm here with Alice and Elizabeth, and we're doing Movement Museum, where we talk about dance on your radio, on your computer, on your mobile device, just in the air. It's on the radio, it's at CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on your cable dial, movement-museum.blogspot.com on the various computers and mobile devices and so on and sundry. And I think this week I'm just going to continue talking because I will not forget the poem. This is called To a Gitana Dancing, or Gitana Dancing, and it's by Arthur Symons, who's a British poet from the 19th century. Because you are fair as souls of the lost are fair, and your eyelids laugh with desire, and your laughing feet are winged with desire, and your hands are wanton and sweet, is the promise of love in your lips and the rose in your hair, sweet, unfaded, a promise sweet to be sought. And the maze you tread is as old as the world is old. Therefore you hold me, body and soul, in your hold. And time, as you dance, is not, and the world is as naught. You dance, and I know the desire of all flesh, and the pain of all longing, for body, you beckon, repel, entreat, and entice, and bewilder, and build up, link by link with deliberate steps of a flower-soft chain. You laugh, and I know the despair, and you smile, and I know the delight of your love, and the flower in your hair is a star. It brightens, I follow, it fades, I see it afar. You pause, I awake, have I dreamt? Was it longer ago than a dream that I saw you smile? For you turn, as a startled beast in the toils, it is you that entreat, desperate, hating the coils that have fastened your feet. The desire you desired that has come, and your lips now yearn, your hands now ache, and your feet faint for love, longing has taken hold on you. You, the witch of desire, and you pause, and anew, your stillness moves, and you pause, and your hands move. Time as you dance is as naught, and the moments seem swift as eternity. Time is at end, for you close eyes and lips and hands in sudden repose. You smile. Was it all no longer ago than a dream? My guess is he was, his hormones were acting up when he wrote that. So how are you doing?
I'm doing well.
That's good. Yeah, we have a, I don't know, the regular jam-packed show here. But you saw Danse Buissonnière.
Yes, last Thursday night.
Yes.
It was. There's two versions of Danse Buissonnière this year. There's the Class 2010, and there's the Les Gradués, which is happening tonight.
Yeah. And it's tonight, tomorrow, and Friday as well.
The 8th, the 9th, and the 10th at 7:30, and the 11th at 4 p.m.
No, we're the 23rd.
October.
I thought it was the 25th.
Oh, shoot. I just wrote these dates down automatically, but that doesn't make any sense, does
no,
it? No, it's, yeah, it's definitely...
It's this week, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and...
And it is 7:30, though, a warning.
Okay.
I tend to always assume that a show is at 8, and sometimes get in trouble for that. But anyway, no. Mm-hmm. So last week, I saw the Class 2010, which is... The newer choreographers, I don't know, everyone from Concordia and UCAM and LADMI, you get out of the program and you go and you apply for Danse Buissonnière.
Do you know what Buissonnière means?
Actually, no, I don't.
I'm going to have to look it up one of these days.
We can sound a little smarter. But yeah, it's like a next step goal when you finish dance program. It's a really good springboard for young choreographers to get out there. Tangente will choose, I think I understand this correctly, a few people from that, a few choreographers from that show, and they'll be in the Danse Les Gradués the next year with a longer time slot. And so that's what happened last year as well, which is why tonight's show is going to be fewer choreographers and who've had a little bit more experience. And also you can be invited from Danse Buissonnière into the Tangente season. So it's really, it's a good opportunity, definitely. So I had a couple of peers in the show, which is great because it's always super impressive when you see who got in, who didn't, you know. And it's also an interesting kind of show to go to because it's not a Théâtre Maisonneuve show. You know, it not intentionally works in progress, but definitely works with a lot more room to grow. Yeah. And it's interesting sometimes to go and see those shows, especially as a choreographer myself.
It's not now knowing sort of the background, it suddenly makes it much more interesting to sort of, yeah, to get to see the this year's class so that you can then see how they progress over a year.
Yeah.
And although trying to remember what I saw last year, ooh, that's going to be sort of difficult.
For sure.
I'm going to have to take very strong notes.
I didn't get to see it last year.
No,
so
and it's there.
This sort of thing. Experience.
I've always taken this sort of attitude that I prefer much more what I would call finished works or closer to being finished works, which is why I'm going to see the L'Écrit.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of figure out, got that idea that was like really the early stage dance making.
Yeah.
And and so it's the sort of thing of trying, but no, I'm going to have to, next year I'll have to remember that. Go see the 2011 group, so that,
yeah.
And then the 2012. Do you have a list of who was there?
Yes.
Because we should get the names out of there first, get them all on the radio and make them happy.
Maryse Damcourt from École de Danse de Québec. And this is actually fun too because everybody's from somewhere different, which is really nice. Well, not everybody. Anyway, Sarah Dalava from UQAM, Katia Marie Germain from Concordia, Patrick Lloyd Brennan from Concordia, Dorian Nuskind Oder from NYU, Tisch School for the Arts, and Raphael Perrault from UQAM, and invited guest, Allison Hooks from the Juilliard School.
Oh, okay. So they even have that. I thought it was all just local.
Yeah, actually, myself too, until I read the program. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of interesting.
So who takes the cake? Who was the rising star to keep an eye out for?
What I would say is what was going on in my brain while I was watching the show for a lot of the pieces was, where would I take this? What would I do if I got to have a conversation with that choreographer and like, what is missing? What do I want more of? And there was one piece where that wasn't in my mind and I was just interpreting it more on a emotional level. And that was Katia Marie Germain from Concordia. The piece was polished. And I think too, because I know her and I've seen this piece the seed of this piece before, and to finally see it reach this point, obviously she's spent a lot of time on that, and I don't know about the other choreographers, but it helped because it was clean, it was clear, and it was really impressive, really beautiful. It was a female duet.
Did her piece have a name?
Sorry, I don't have the names.
Okay. That's okay. They didn't. Oh, we're gonna get them to come out with press releases and sort of press kits and stuff like that, so we can look more professional next year.
Yeah, sounds good. But yes. I'll hold on to my program.
So you're saying two dancers?
Yeah, two female dancers, and they both kind of have this loose, short hair, and these flowered dresses, and there's a flowered carpet, kind of on an angle in the middle of the floor, and it's such a striking image, and with the lights on it, like Tangente, you can do some fun stuff with lights in there, and they had it kind of glowing almost, and it was lovely. They were, a lot of their movements were sharp and then slow and then flop and then weight onto one another, and it was real weight, and there was an emotion behind it, you know? There was like this struggle, this push-pull, this wanting, this pushing away, but very abstracted, and it was gorgeous, and a lot of it was about little head movements, and with the hair in the face, so you could hardly see their faces. And it was just a beautiful piece, like the aesthetic of it was perfect.
Okay. You
know? It was lovely.
In terms of the, you talk about the sort of speed of the gestures and speed of the movements in terms mm-hmm. of the type of movement. Would you consider it, does it fit into any nice little cubby hole so that I can close my eyes and imagine what they moved like, or is it?
Well, it was a contrast. There was a lot of contrast. So there were these, you know, sharp, precise movements without much kind of reverb, just mm-hmm. a hit, a fall.
So sort of like doing the robot?
Doing the robot. Yes, but not as consistent, like,
okay.
Just like, because it was mixed in with kind of these slower, mm-hmm. kind of, trance.
Okay,
and then, movements, yeah, and then it hit.
Mm-hmm. And so it'd be sort of, and those slow movements would be the sort of thing where, yeah, I'm just looking for some like large hook to hang it on, sort of like jazz or.
No, it was very much a modern contemporary piece. With the vocabulary, there were, you know, like lying on the ground, kicking the foot out, and from standing to falling to spinning up and things like that.
Okay.
Yeah. Does that paint a better picture?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And let me spit this out properly. What were the costumes like?
The flower dresses.
Oh, sorry, yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Just lovely.
Okay. Anything else there worth noting?
I think just the idea of the container, like it developed and went new places, but it never kind of broke the rules that Katya had created around the piece.
Okay.
If that makes mm-hmm. sense, you know, she set up this world and they lived through it from beginning to end without kind of, I think there's a fear sometimes that the audience is getting bored, so you go somewhere else, even when it doesn't make any sense. So that was, I really appreciate that.
Okay. And the other shows, anything else worth noting about?
I wanted to talk about Alison Hooks from the Juilliard School, because I think it got me thinking the most, not necessarily in a good way, but it keeps coming up into my brain. I'm really surprised to see that she was the invited guest. I'm not sure. Perhaps it's because they were looking for a totally different flavor than we have in Montreal or something like that. But it almost went back to the beginning of contemporary dance. Like, they were obviously classically trained, and she was using that a lot of classic vocabulary in this piece, but then interspliced with these, you know, bizarre movements, put the skirt in your mouth and crawl around on your hands and things like that, and then get up and like do a couple kicks. And I just found it so disconnected and so bizarre. And they had the most amazing costumes, though. There were these silver dresses with low backs and hoops at the end of the skirts, and they could lift them up over their head, and there was like a mauve on the other side, and they had mauve bodysuits on the other side, and they were in these like little wormholes. It was great. It was fun. And I would love to play with one of those. Absolutely. But it felt like all just dressing on top of something that didn't necessarily.
Yeah, how many dancers were there?
There were three female dancers in these lovely dresses, and then a male dancer in a black bodysuit that was also kind of metallic and full tights, and it was a little awkward. And I felt too, comparing it to like classical into modern, kind of that little breakaway, it seemed like they were exploring this new world they weren't quite comfortable in, and none of their faces were alive. They were just so waiting for the next step, and there was no
Could that
heart.
Be part of the sort of the idea behind the choreography, in terms of just play it straight and keep this up? Because
but you can play it straight and still be open to the audience. And actually, I think that's, I had a conversation with a professor once about this. It's the hardest thing. It's easy to be open to your audience when that is your goal, like when your theme and your emotional state is kind of throwing it out there. And it's so difficult to try and express this kind of interior feeling, but still send it out there. But it's necessary, because you still have to be able to connect with your audience, even if you're intention is to be small and quiet.
Okay.
So anyway, I was a little disappointed with that piece, but I was so intrigued. Like, where could this go? This could be so exciting. And I think just with the brief moments of kind of more contemporary movement, when they were playing with the costumes, it was like, yes, like, I feel like maybe she's just shy to go there as a choreographer, because it could be so exciting. But I felt like that what I was saying with that Katya didn't do, it seemed like she kept trying to give the audience what she thinks the audience wants, instead of just
constantly new, as opposed to working through something.
But this is all hypothetical. Mm-hmm. I'm not her. I've never met her. But this is the impression I got.
We're gonna have to go next year to see, or the graduate, see her come back.
Yeah, for sure.
Anything else?
What can I talk about? I can talk about Patrick Lloyd Brennan.
Okay.
This was a piece that was very much... it's one of those borderline, is it contemporary dance, you know, kind of piece. And it's like it was like a happening. It was like an event and a staging. He had, I think, 12 people.
Yeah, well, that's a lot of people.
Yeah. Yeah, and they were all men and women, almost half-half, I think. The women were in bodysuits or otherwise, like, you know, short underwear and tank tops kind of thing, and heels. And the boys were all in black underwear and shoes.
Again, somebody's hormones are raging.
Oh, yeah, love it, love it, love it. And they had lamps, 4 lamps around the room, and turning them off and on. And they had a ghetto blaster on stage and just kind of switching through pop songs kind of thing, but like dirty grinding pop songs. And they would go around and this was... Again, the staging was really well done. Like they all came out at first and stood right in front of the audience, like right up next to us, but we're staring back with the full tangente open, that whole space. And then that's where everyone stood. And then every once in a while, someone would go out and start dancing or thrusting into the air.
So you were able to see over them or
yeah.
help the people in the front row as well?
I don't know. I was sitting really far back, but it was nice to see because they weren't lit. So it was like this forest of silhouettes and then people in the back with just, and the lights too, you know, like the stage kept getting darker and brighter in different spots as they were turning on and off the lights. So it was a nice composition. It was one of those things where, because it went on for so long and it was the same concept that you just, your eyes wander and it's interesting. Like it's like one of those paintings where there's a lot going on and you're trying to find out where the staircase leads and things like that. So, and it was just silly and it was fun and disturbing a little bit, you know. So yeah, that was a good time for okay. sure. It was nice too because all the pieces were so different, and I kept saying it was amazing that they put the lights on in between each piece because we needed that break to be like, okay, now get ready for something completely different. So yeah, I was glad there was a piece like that in the show.
Cool.
Yeah.
Which point now I'm going to have to note it down and remember to go see it next year.
For sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I would definitely go back because it's, especially as an artist, I think it's really important to see work in that stage. For sure.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Which point, thank you very much. Enjoy the show tonight and don't tell me about it because I go see it on Friday.
Okay.
I think it is, or Saturday, the 25th.
And we'll just talk it out next
yes.
Thursday.
Uh-huh. You get the left side, I get the right side, you get the black, I get the white, or something like that.
Okay.
yeah, we now have part two of our the Jean Reno interview from Visage de la Danse, which took place last year at Cirque Est. This year, it's happening again. Briefly noted, October 5th, Christian Spuck, who is a German choreographer with Les Grands Ballets Canadiens, and he's going to be talking to Alina Apostelska at the Goethe Institute. But here, we got... Part two of Jean Reno. Visage de la Danse were a series of interviews conducted by writer and dance journalist Aline Apostolska during the 2009-10 dance season. They were held once a month, alternating among three spaces: Cirque Est, Centre Choreographique, the Agora de la Danse, and the studio of the Grand Ballet Canadien de Montréal. The first subject was Jean Reno, founder of Le Groupe de la Place Royale and recipient of the Governor General's Award, the Order of Canada, and the Prix du Québec. Movement Museum recorded the proceedings and edited the interviews for multi-part broadcast. They will air as time allows over the following weeks.
C'est quand on dit son, c'est d'oublier ce qui sont les codes, oui. Ce qui sont les lois fondamentales. De, oui, effectivement, pour revenir d'instinct avec ce qu'on porte en soi, qui est vraiment la richesse finalement de la création. Je vais vous dire une chose. C'est un autre moment dans la... C'est un peu la même chose avec la littérature, c'est quand même la même chose avec la musique. On ne peut pas imaginer que les grands classiques, les Mozart, les Bach, les Monteverdi... Je ne sais pas si on pourrait parler d'automatisme avec eux. Sauf que quand il y avait le ballet classique, on comptait énormément sur les interprètes. Et à partir du moment où on part d'une création beaucoup plus contemporaine, on part de la création beaucoup plus, plus libre et on y met les interprètes, sauf que pour être capable de danser ou de jouer de la musique de nos grands classiques, il faut avoir une grande, grande technique et l'interprète est quand même très important. Vous allez danser une Gisèle ou je sais pas, si vous n'avez pas un grand artiste derrière, ça passe presque inaperçu.
Bien sûr.
Et si vous avez des grands pianistes, la même chose, des grands musiciens, des grands artistes, des grands peintres, mais au fond, il y a toujours une part d'instinct dans l'artiste quand on... de n'importe quelle génération, on peut parler. Non, parce que Bordua, d'ailleurs, à ce moment-là, envoie une lettre à ma sœur, d'ailleurs, que j'ai chez moi. Il envoie une copie de tout ça pour voir s'ils sont bien d'accord pour signer et tout. Et puis, il dit que, bon, elle demande si ma petite sœur, qui est à New York, elle me dit, j'aimerais mieux pas avoir trop jeune parce que si on a des problèmes avec eux, d'ailleurs, ils en ont eu, n'est-ce pas? J'aimerais pas que c'est trop jeune pour être confronté à des difficultés. Parce que moi, j'avais été à Montréal pendant plusieurs mois chez Fernand. Nous rencontrions tout le temps chez lui, tout le monde venait là, on jouait de la musique. C'est là où on avait l'histoire du soldat que Fernand avait acheté, qu'on ne trouvait plus. Et quand Stravinsky est venu jouer, je pense qu'il venait jouer le sac à ce moment-là, j'avais demandé à M. Koudriadzir, est-ce que vous pourriez m'amener à Stravinsky, je veux lui parler. Alors, j'étais allée dans les coulisses et j'avais parlé à Stravinsky. Je lui avais dit, vous savez, je vous ai découvert par l'histoire du soldat qu'on avait chez mon beau-frère. Alors, il me dit, qui dirigeait? J'ai dit, c'est vous. Alors, il dit, je cherche. Je ne le trouve plus. C'est épuisé. Puis alors, il était là. Mais je ne savais plus où c'était rendu parce que ma soeur était déjà rendue en Europe avec Fernand. On ne savait plus où c'était. Les noms que vous mentionnez là, par exemple, c'est qu'on s'est retrouvés à Paris. Et lorsque j'ai quitté New York, après avoir eu des révélations avec Morton Feldman qui m'amenait partout dans les musées, dans les concerts, c'était absolument formidable. Je parlais pas encore l'anglais, mais j'essayais de le saisir. Puis on discutait, mais enfin. Et rendu à Paris, je réalise que je suis dans un monde de musées. Parce que c'est l'après-guerre. Alors, je vais à Paris parce que, surtout, ben d'abord, mes deux sœurs sont là. Et mon copain, que je marie à ce moment-là, parce que si les parents voulaient nous aider, il fallait être marié, bien sûr. Il venait faire une psychanalyse avec Lacan pour...
Avec Lacan lui-même.
Jacques Lacan, oui. Parce que, ben, d'ailleurs, il avait fait le tour de tous les psychanalystes parce qu'il fallait qu'il choisisse quelqu'un pour faire sa didactique. Et il était médecin. Et puis, alors, il voulait revenir à Montréal travailler en psychanalyse. Alors, donc, on s'en va, je quitte New York. Lui est venu à New York essayer de faire une psychanalyse à New York pour qu'on puisse rester pour moi dans ce milieu-là. Sauf que il ne possède pas suffisamment l'anglais pour que le psychanalyste lui dise
c'est embêtant, c'est un lacanien.
Alors, vous seriez mieux en France. Alors, on s'en va en France. Et c'est dommage parce que c'est un moment où j'aurais probablement fait carrière là, pendant un certain temps à New York.
Ah, vous étiez sur ce point-là?
Oui, exactement. Oui. Puis alors, j'enseignais, j'avais remplacé mon professeur Mary, je donnais ses cours quand elle n'était pas là ou quand elle s'est fait opérer, puis je sais pas. Et j'étais dans le milieu et alors j'avais commencé à travailler avec Cunningham et je pense que normalement ça aurait été facile de... Oui, parce que finalement, je me dis, de toute façon, je vais aller en France, puis je vais faire quelque chose là. Et là, j'arrive là, et puis il n'y a pas personne qui... ça m'ouvre aucune porte dans des gens contemporains.
Forcément.
Je veux aller travailler pour moi, puis bon, faire mes créations. Alors, je ne sais pas où aller. Quelqu'un me dit, mais va donc à l'American Club. Il y a des grands, grands studios là qui sont assez libres. Va les voir. Alors, je vais les voir. Et puis, on me dit, bien sûr, vous pouvez venir travailler tous les jours si vous voulez, à condition que vous donniez quelques cours. Parce qu'on nous demande beaucoup des cours en contemporain de danse moderne. Bon. Alors, j'ai commencé à donner des cours et... C'était tous des Américains qui venaient prendre ces cours-là. Quelques Français qui venaient prendre ces cours-là. Quand j'essayais de les mettre au sol pour faire des exercices, ils disaient « Ah non, c'est trop froid, le plancher est froid, on ne va pas descendre sur le plancher, qu'est-ce que vous voulez qu'on fasse? C'est sale sur le plancher. Tu » sais. Les Français ne voulaient pas prendre les cours. Ça n'a pas été long, ça veut dire, c'est juste une petite période de... Ben, c'était un peu difficile, sauf que finalement, quand même, en 50, au bout de deux ans et demi, oui. J'étais là. Jean-Paul Riopel m'a dit, mais pourquoi tu fais pas simplement, fais un spectacle? Parce qu'il y avait d'ailleurs un petit théâtre, il y avait une petite scène. Alors, j'ai dit oui, au fond, je vous donne. Alors, puis il y avait Pierre Mercure qui était arrivé, qui venait travailler avec Nadia Boulanger, je crois. Et... Qui avait écrit pour nous en musique. Alors donc, Jean-Paul me dit, mais oui, alors qu'est-ce que tu... As-tu un petit peu de budget? J'ai rien, mais en tout cas. Mais j'ai dit, on va essayer de faire ce qu'on peut, et puis bon. Alors là, il y a Hélène McGee qui fait partie de Martha Graham, qui est là en visite, qui est là pour quelques mois, qui avait donné d'ailleurs, à cet endroit-là, au American Town, une démonstration de classe, de technique de Martha Graham. Époustouflante, hein? Ces classes-là, c'était absolument renversant. Elle avait une technique fabuleuse, sauf que je regardais ça, mais je lui dis, est-ce que tu voudrais partager un spectacle avec moi? Elle m'a dit, ben non, je peux pas, parce que Martha veut pas qu'on travaille avec d'autres gens que ceux qui font partie de Martha Graham Company. Bon. Alors, j'ai dit, très bien. Mais, alors, je fais le spectacle. Alors, il y a Pierre Mercure qui veut écrire. Il y a sa femme qui, à ce moment-là, est Monique Mercure qui joue le violoncelle. Lui joue le basson. Il y a Gabriel Charpentier qui joue le piano. Il y a Rosen, qui est un Américain qui est là aussi, qui joue un autre instrument. Enfin, bref, tout le monde, on se met ensemble. Tout le monde est là, sauf qu'il y a une danseuse seulement, c'est moi qui suis tout seul.
C'est déjà alors, pas mal.
Alors, puis là, mon Jean-Paul m'a dit, mais qu'est-ce qu'on va faire? Alors, à un moment donné, je fais des répétitions pour écouter la musique que Pierre est en train d'écrire. Et puis, ça change toujours. Et puis... Alors, je me dis, c'est drôle, mais c'est jamais la même chose, mais ça change, parce que lui, de jour en jour, il rajoutait, oui, il changeait des choses en musique, et puis c'est du vrai John Cage, finalement. Quand on y pense, je veux dire, au point de vue, au point de vue du son, mais je veux dire, au point de vue de la mentalité, c'était quelque chose qu'il fallait que ça soit complètement à part. Bon. Alors, on met tout ça ensemble et puis Jean-Paul décide qu'il va aller chercher une lanterne magique et puis qu'il va dessiner des petites diapos puis on va les mettre dans ça parce qu'on n'a pas d'éclairage, on n'a rien. Alors, et puis il projette ça sur le mur et comme il trouve que c'est un peu statique, alors il prend ses cheveux, il déchire ses cheveux et puis il jette ça dans la diapo, dans la lanterne. Alors donc, ça chauffe, ça brûle et ça se met à bouger. Alors tout le mur bouge. Alors là, je regarde ça. J'ai plus besoin de danser, c'est formidable. Non, ma petite fille, c'est pour toi. On a fait un spectacle, François oui. Sullivan et moi. Et ça, ce sont mes danses. Et il y avait les danses de François Sullivan.
Oui.
Et je dansais dans les danses de Françoise, mais ça, ce sont les solos que moi, je faisais, qui ont été repris par Louise Bédard.
C'est ça, c'est ce que je dis, ce n'est pas l'enregistrement de 1948,
mais c'est une pièce qui n'était pas de François Sullivan, c'est parce qu'on a parlé de...
C'est la vôtre, et oui. c'est un solo que vous interprétiez déjà en 1948, alors ça va déjà...
J'avais travaillé à New York, oui. Mais c'est drôle, on n'a pas la respiration, c'est bizarre, hein? Ça fait étrange de voir ça. Quand je suis arrivée à New York, comme j'étais vraiment étonnée de voir toute la misère que je voyais, la pauvreté, la violence qui était autour de nous. Alors ça m'impressionnait beaucoup et j'ai essayé d'expliquer dans ma tête, dans ma création, comment je voyais cette espèce de vie là-bas à New York, comment je trouvais ça terriblement difficile. Alors cette déformation-là, j'avais commencé par essayer de faire ça avec un bas et puis Et après ça, je m'étais dit non, j'ai pas besoin de ça, je vais juste essayer d'expliquer comment on se sent dans ce monde si difficile et si dur. Quand je vais chercher de la musique, ce n'est pas pour illustrer quoi que ce soit ou ma danse, illustrer la musique. C'est tout simplement en parallèle, si vous voulez, au niveau de l'atmosphère, du monde intérieur, de la sensibilité, mais pas du tout en rapport à illustrer l'un par l'autre, pas du tout. Alors, à certains moments donné, je peux très bien travailler sans musique. Uh-huh. Ou alors je faisais des instruments sur les danseurs, j'avais des pastilles, j'avais des morceaux de bois je travaillais ou j'étais inspirée par de la musique. Ah oui, c'était que pour moi, ce que je venais chercher dans tout ce qui était contemporain pour moi, je voulais qu'on me laisse la liberté d'être moi-même. Et quand on allait chez Martha Graham, on devenait un outil Martha Graham.
Oui.
C'était John Cage qui lui avait dit,
non.
Si tu ne sors pas de là, moi je ne peux pas travailler avec toi en musique parce que c'est pas ça du tout que je veux voir. Et Mercy sorti avec grand plaisir parce que je pense qu'il avait déjà passé quelques années là. Je l'ai vu d'ailleurs danser avec chez Martha. Et il voulait faire autre chose d'ailleurs.
Oui.
Quand on parle de Merce Cunningham au niveau de son travail, c'est tellement, tellement unique et c'est tellement spécial que moi j'ai une grande admiration pour lui. Parce
oui,
que j'ai vu encore dernièrement des choses de lui là, depuis à sa mort. Vincent Warren m'a passé des têtes. Alors là, c'est extraordinaire de voir cette espèce de compréhension du monde de la danse, du mouvement qui éclate, mais qui finalement est d'une sobriété absolument incroyable. Il y a un groupe là d'ailleurs, ils sont
oui.
Quelques-uns, et puis les autres sont anglais, sont juifs, mais c'est un groupe et ça s'appelle la Société de psychanalystes. Et puis au bout de quelques années, ce cher Jean-Pierre, qui était mon mari, s'aperçoit qu'il ne peut pas aider ses malades seulement avec de la psychanalyse, parce que l'angoisse est incontrôlable et c'est trop long. Ça ne les aide pas suffisamment. Alors, il veut chercher des médicaments. Alors, il va avec il se retourne à la science pour voir comment on peut
les
aider.
À la psychiatrie.
Et d'ailleurs, je pense que mon cher mari, qui était Jean-Pierre, il croyait très, très, très fort à Freud. Beaucoup plus que, par exemple, à Jung ou aux autres qui pouvaient faire des...
Et beaucoup plus qu'à Lacan.
Lacan était freudien, freudien. Alors finalement, c'était pour ça qu'il avait choisi Lacan. Je me disais toujours, comment se fait-il qu'il a choisi Lacan? Parce que quand on lisait, quand on allait entendre ses conférences, personne ne comprenait rien. C'était d'une abstraction totale. Et puis moi, j'arrivais toujours à comprendre quelque chose ou à saisir quelque chose qu'il pouvait faire comme moi. Mais je disais, oui, moi j'ai compris quelque chose. Mais... Dans le milieu où on était tous les artistes, qu'on était les Gauvreaux, les Fernand, on lisait Freud.
Oui.
Et on était fascinés par tout ce qu'il nous apprenait à partir des rêves, l'analyse des rêves et tout. Alors donc c'était
des symboles.
Oui, on était très très fascinés par toute cette découverte psychologique. C'était toute cette façon de voir... c'était vraiment pénible, cette époque-là où on
début des
pas.
Années 50,
oui. D'ailleurs, on accouchait et puis on n'avait aucune notion de ce que c'était, la respiration, comment, de sorte que moi j'avais un siège et puis ça m'a pris 48 heures. On n'arrivait pas. Ces médecins-là ne nous aidaient pas non plus. Mais aujourd'hui, je trouve ça. Ah, je suis émerveillée de voir ce qu'on fait maintenant avec la maternité, comment on arrive à tout expliquer. Bon, je trouvais ça bien intéressant de faire ça, mais je me disais, il faut que je fasse aussi autre chose. Je ne peux pas faire que ça, parce que c'était pour moi très important de pouvoir m'exprimer, de pouvoir faire autre chose. Alors, j'ai voulu, et c'est Françoise Riopelle qui, revenant de Paris à Montréal, me dit, écoute, il ne se passe rien en danse ici, il faut absolument qu'on fasse quelque chose. Il se passait quelque chose, il y avait des petites choses, mais je veux dire, bon, il faut qu'on fasse quelque chose, viens-t'en, il faut que tu reviennes à la danse, parce que quand même, on n'a pas assez de monde ici pour pouvoir, il faut qu'on reparte ensemble. Mmh. Et c'est comme ça que j'ai recommencé à travailler, et elle, à ce moment-là, avait quitté Jean-Paul Riopelle et elle était avec Pierre Mercure. Et là, c'est là où on a fait des soirées chez eux, dans la maison chez eux, des soirées de spectacle, de danse, de musique. Tout ça, c'était assez intéressant d'ailleurs. C'est-à-dire qu'il y a le festival de danse, musique et de danse contemporaine où Françoise Riopelle fait une soirée, une chorégraphie. C'est Pierre Mercure qui a monté ce festival de danse et musique. Il avait invité Merce Cunningham, James Waring, dont toutes les contemporains, Louise, Yvonne Rainer, tout ce monde-là était dans ce spectacle-là.
C'est la fin des années
50. Oui. Il y avait John Cage, il y avait Earl Brown, il y avait tous ces musiciens de l'époque. Et alors, à ce moment-là, Françoise me demande de danser parce qu'il y a une de ses danseuses de New York qui s'est blessée. Alors, mon cher époux ne veut pas parce qu'il est en vacances pendant 15 jours à la campagne avec les enfants, puis il veut pas. Et puis finalement, je me sauve. Et puis là, je me dis, je peux pas faire ça à Françoise, il faut que j'aille l'aider. Alors, je m'en vais apprendre. Et je le laisse avec les enfants et puis la bonne qui vient garder. Et puis, pendant 3-4 jours, je vais apprendre l'œuvre et puis je danse. Et lui vient voir cette soirée-là au festival. Et c'est Mousseau qui avait fait le décor, puis il y en a qui avaient écrit la musique. Et tout à coup, il vient dans la coulisse et il pleure. Il y a des larmes. Et il me dit, Jeanne, je m'excuse, je n'avais rien compris. Alors, dorénavant, je veux que tu travailles, que tu danses. Alors donc, à ce moment-là, j'ai eu carte blanche pour pouvoir travailler, et parce que tout le temps que j'ai eu le groupe La Valse Royale, j'ai jamais pris un sou, j'ai jamais été payée, je travaillais depuis des années, ça fait 7 ans, et puis j'avais jamais d'argent parce que il me demandait pas de rentrer de l'argent, quoi que ce soit, il était médecin, puis voilà. Ben, ça a été assez bien reçu parce que c'était dans le petit théâtre à Place Ville-Marie. On a joué quand même là pendant 6 semaines, je crois.
Combien de semaines?
6 semaines.
Oh!
Victorio.
Tout à fait impossible aujourd'hui.
Les affiches, les grandes affiches qui ont gagné des prix à New York d'ailleurs. Et dans les danseuses, il y avait Dale Adam qui était devenu un mannequin de la revue Elle française, qui était très très connue à un moment donné, qui était toute jeune là-dedans.
Oui.
Et puis, il y avait... ça fait bizarre de voir ça, parce que ça n'a pas beaucoup de sens dans le sens. Hein? Bon, c'est Dale Adam, c'était ça qui a été quand même après. Là.
Pourquoi dites-vous que ça n'a pas beaucoup de sens?
Mais c'est parce que c'est coupé, c'est simplement des coupures. Hein? Ça ne fait pas partie de l'œuvre vraiment. Ils ont ramassé ça et c'est Raymond Brousseau qui m'a dit, je l'ai fait, ça c'est les décors de Fernand Ledeux. Il m'a dit, écoute, j'ai rassemblé ça pour que tu aies quand même un souvenir de ce spectacle-là que tu avais fait. C'est que le groupe de la Place Royale, on n'a rien d'eux là, parce que c'est dommage, parce que c'était quand même plus important que tout ça. Alors là, je sens le besoin de fonder une compagnie, de faire quelque chose pour qu'on puisse, à ce moment-là, avoir des danseurs et demander quelques subventions, parce que ça commençait à ce moment-là d'avoir des subventions pour la danse. alors que c'était beaucoup plus sur la danse classique, mais enfin quand même, il y avait des espoirs. Et je fonde donc le groupe La Place Royale.
Avec
et,
Peter Bonham.
Alors donc, je vais chercher les danseurs qui avaient fait partie de l'Expression 65, qui était Peter Bonham. Alors je lui dis, viens avec moi, il faut que tu viennes. Je vais partir l'école qui va probablement aider un peu à soutenir le studio et tout, puis on va faire de la création. Alors, Peter vient et il m'assiste, mais alors lui, il est danseur de ballet au départ, là. Alors, il ne peut pas enseigner de moderne, alors je donne les classes en moderne le matin. Et lui, plus tard, donne un cours de ballet, puis de jazz. C'est assez amusant de voir comment il arrivait à s'intégrer là-dedans. Et finalement, on a toutes sortes de personnes qui se joignent à nous pour des spectacles. Van Dantini qui vient des grands ballets. Il y a Vincent Warren qui vient souvent parce qu'il était tellement généreux avec nous. Il adorait ça, venir travailler avec nous. Il y avait plusieurs danseurs comme ça, de Rosemary Tom. C'était tous des professionnels, finalement, qui faisaient que le noyau de mes danseurs étaient des gens professionnels. Puis, comme on avait aussi parti tout un jeune groupe, dont Jean-Pierre Perrault, qui faisait partie de ça, et d'autres, on les joignait tranquillement dans la compagnie au fur et à mesure. Il y avait aussi Claire Adamchik qui venait ici, qui est là d'ailleurs, et qui venait prendre les cours et qui, normalement, je l'aurais probablement amenée tranquillement dans la compagnie, sauf qu'elle est devenue enceinte. Alors, on lui a dit bonjour.
Thank you very much for listening to this multi-part interview with Jean Renaud, recorded as part of the Visage de la Danse series of interviews during the 09-10 dance season. Further parts will air as time allows on Movement Museum in the future. And we're back. My name's Zeke. I'm here with Allison Elizabeth, and now we have Marie-Hélène as well. It's 2:48 or thereabouts, and you're listening to Movement Museum, where we talk about dance on your radio, on your computer, on your mobile device, all over the place. 90.3 FM on your radio, 91.7 on your cable dial, and movement-museum.blogspot.com on your computer or mobile device. So how are you doing, Marie-Hélène?
Bonjour, ça va bien, et vous deux?
Très bien, merci.
I'm very happy to be back.
Merci de venir. Vous avez des choses à nous dire sur la danse ici en ville pour des gens qui veulent faire la danse.
Yes, well, because today is the first day of the fall and that winter is coming, I thought I would mention two opportunities to dance outdoors before the winter comes and until next spring. Mm-hmm. Two left, because of course, during the summer, you can go dancing outdoors, partner dancing outdoors in Montreal every night. Now it's almost over. There's only one group that still organizes Argentine tango dances Thursday evenings, so that's...
Do they choose to close it because of the temperature, because of the just impending, they think it's going to snow, or...?
Well, it's a lot of work. Very often it's schools who organize, partner dancing schools who organize those events during the summer, and when the fall comes back, they get busy giving the classes,
so it's
a lot of time and staff, so, and also it gets colder, darker at night, but there's one school, Tango Libre, from the Plateau, mm-hmm. that still organizes tonight and next Thursday in Parc Laurier on the Plateau, outdoor tango dancing, it's free. 7:30 to 9, and of course, if it rains, it's cancelled. It's a good opportunity to go even just to watch if you want to see how it goes, and they give it a little intro class, and that could be fun. And then, as I say, starting next May, as early as next May, you'll be outdoor dancing every night. The second thing I want to mention, of course, is the talk of the town this weekend, is Les Journées de la Culture. There are, maybe you've talked about them already, numerous dance-related activities
but
this weekend.
All over the province.
All over the province.
Yes.
And in Montreal, all kinds as well. And among those dance activities, a few deal with partner dancing. And one of them is on Thursday, on Sunday, from 11 to 5, at Les Serres Municipales de Verdun. Now, again, for me, even if you don't want to dance any of the dances that will be either demonstrated there or little workshops will be organized, you might just want to go see the spot. It's very beautiful. Yes. They'll have, I have the list here, they have some baladi, rock and roll, dances from the 19th century, vals, polka, mazurka, they'll have some Bollywood, all kinds of stuff. But the place, for those who don't know it, is worth going, especially there'll be a little free shuttle going there all day from the Mont-Royal metro station. I can take you there.
That's convenient to know.
Yes, and this place, this outdoor dance floor, is located by the river, right in front of the Douglas Hospital, for those who know the area. So it's close to either Métro de l'Église or Verdun.
And it's very, very, we were just talking about that while the Jean Reno interview was happening. That whole waterfront area around the city, whether it's Verdun or Lachine, it's beautiful.
It's beautiful. People who like to bicycle usually know it. Why it's interesting, many reasons people might want to go dancing there this Sunday or all next summer. It's an outdoor floor, it's concrete, but it's actually easier to dance on that concrete than on most other outdoor floors that we have in the city. It was well built. There's a roof on top of it, so even if it rains a little bit, activities are not canceled. And as I said, the view on the river and the fresh air, it's fabulous. So this weekend is a good opportunity.
And who's the ones who are organizing that one?
Well, as I said, it's part of Les Journées de la Culture, and many groups are participating this weekend, this Sunday, depending on the dances. They'll be doing one after the other from 11.
So it's not one group, it's multiple groups. And it's sort of like, let's bring the entire community down here.
That's right. Okay. And next summer, as I say, every night, there's one night for salsa, one night for Argentine tango. Mm-hmm. There's some country dancing there, ballroom, they have swing. It's a place to discover. It's always free.
Of the places to dance outdoors, Is that one in Verdun your favorite?
Oh, definitely. And not only my favorite, I think it's everybody's favorite. It's a little difficult to get there in a car. People say it's a little far, but very easy by metro and by bicycle, and actually lots of parking for those who drive. Beautiful.
Mm-hmm. So. Okay. And then the one that's on the tango at Parc Laurier on Thursday, which is tonight, right?
And next week, and that's it until next summer.
Okay. What sort of floor do they use or dance for? Because we've been discussing that earlier in terms of the needs of people who are dancing.
Oh, they just dance in front of the chalet there. There's no dance floor, really. They just, gather at one point and somebody brings the music and they dance. A bit like they do on, it's the same group, Tango Libre, that does dances in Parc La Fontaine on Sundays all summer. They just dance in one part of the park. People meet there. So it's a dance floor at all, but a place to meet and dance. Oh. This is why Verdun is so nice, because you actually have a floor.
Okay. Cool. At which point, thank you very, very much. Look forward to hearing what you have next time.
And in the meantime, of course, people can always check the website, voulezvousdanceravecmoi.ca. Everything's there.
Cool. Thank you.
You're welcome.
So do you want to do your This Week in Dance History?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
This one I like. It's too bad. It's September 23rd, which is today, is also the day that Bob Fosse died, which is too bad. But it does give us the opportunity to talk about him a little bit. Director, choreographer Bob Fosse forever changed the way audiences around the world viewed dance on the stage and in the film industry in the late 20th century. Visionary, intense, and unbelievably driven, Fosse was an artist whose work was always proactive, entertaining, and quite unlike anything ever seen before. His dances were sexual, physically demanding of even the most highly trained dancers, full of joyous humor as well as bleak cynicism, works that address the full range of human emotions. Through his film, he revolutionized the presentation of dance on screen and paved the way for a whole generation of film and video directors, showing dance through the camera lens as no one had done before, foreshadowing the rise of the MTV era of music video dance. Robert Louis Fosse was born in Chicago, Illinois, on June 23, 1927, and died on September 23, 1987, in Washington, D.C., at the age of 60. Bob was the youngest of six children and quickly learned to win attention from his family through his dancing. It was not long before he was recognized as a child prodigy. His parents sent him to formal lessons where he immersed himself in tap dancing. A small boy who suffered from nagging health problems, he nevertheless was so dedicated that by the time he reached high school, he was already dancing professionally in area nightclubs as part of their sleazy vaudeville and burlesque shows. The sexually free atmosphere of these clubs and the strippers with whom Fosse was in constant contact made a strong impression on him. Fascinated with vaudeville's dark humor and teasing sexual tones, he would later develop these themes into his adult work. After high school, Fosse enlisted in the Navy in 1945, shortly after he arrived at boot camp. VJ Day was declared and World War II officially came to an end. Right. Fosse completed his two-year duty and moved to New York City. For the next 7 years, Fosse went through two rocky marriages with dancers Marianne Niles and Joanne McCracken, all the while performing in a variety of shows on stage and on television. He had a few minor Broadway chorus parts, but his big break came from with his brief appearance in the 1953 MGM movie musical Kiss Me, Kate. Fosse caught the immediate attention of two Broadway acknowledged masters, George Abbott and Jerome Robbins.
Big guys.
Oh, yeah. Fosse's first fully choreographed show was the 1954's Pajama Game, directed by Abbott. The show made Fosse an overnight success and showcased his trademark choreographic style, sexually suggestive forward hip thrusts, the vaudeville humor of hunched shoulders and turned-in feet, the amazing mime-like articulation of hands. He often dressed his dancers in black and put them in white gloves and derbies, recalling the image of Charlie Chaplin. He incorporated all the tricks of vaudeville that he had learned, pratfalls, sleight of hands, double takes. Fosse received the first of his many Tony Awards for Best Choreography for the Pajama Game. His next musical, Damn Yankees, brought more awards and established his lifelong creative collaboration with Gwen Verdon, who had the starring role. With her inspiration, Fosse created a stream of classic dances. By 1960, Fosse was a nationally known and respected choreographer, married to Verdon. By then a beloved Broadway star and father to their child, Nicole. Yet Fosse struggled with many of his producers and directors who wished him to tone down or remove the controversial parts of his dances. Tired of subverting his artistic vision for the sake of being proper, Fosse realized that he needed to be the director as well as the choreographer in order to have control over his dances. From the late 1960s to the late 1970s, Fosse created a number of groundbreaking stage musicals and films. Fosse introduced unique perspective shots and jump cuts. These films and editing techniques would become standard practice for music video directors decades later. His 1972 film, Cabaret, was based on Christopher Isherwood's stories of
Weimar,
Germany. The film was Fosse's biggest public success and won 8 Academy Awards. Fosse's Pippin in 1972 became the highest earning Broadway show in history. Fosse staged and choreographed a variety of shows, special for NBC starring Liza Minnelli, Liza with a Z, which brought Fosse an Emmy Award and made him the first person to ever win top honors in 3 entertainment mediums, stage, film, and television. During rehearsals for the stage musical Chicago in 1975, Fosse suffered a heart attack. He survived and used much of all that traumatic experience in 1979 in his semi-autobiographical dance film, All That Jazz. After a rehearsal for the revival of Sweet Charity in 1987, Fosse suffered a massive heart attack and died on the way to the hospital. Thinking of you, Bob.
No, there, it's always have lots of fun when go see the dance he did for Gwen Verdon on the Ed Sullivan show called Mexican Breakfast.
Oh, yeah?
Yes.
Is this something we can YouTube?
Yes. If you stick in Mexican Breakfast and AOL, it'll be the number one hit on Google. And it is absolutely just jaw-droppingly, amazingly wonderful in a... Yeah, just... It's lots of fun.
And you should definitely do that today in honor of Bob Fosse.
And yet, before, because we are running out of time, although primetime hasn't shown up yet, so we still have a little bit of time here. Been asked to mention that there's the Menu Continental, Speak of the Devil, there's primetime. Yeah, Menu Continental with Sylvain Aymard Danse is happening on the 25th, which is part of the Journée de la Culture. And there, that's at Circuit Est, which is at the corner. It's 2020 Sherbrooke Street East, which is at the corner of Delormier. And there he's going to be explaining how he conceived his Très Grand Continental project, which involved over 100 amateur dancers. Yeah, that's right up your alley.
Yeah,
did you participate in the Grand Continental?
I watched it on TV, but it looked like a lot of fun.
Yes, now there he's talking about they're going to be giving you coffee and croissants as well, and then he's going to be doing a two-hour workshop where he's going to teach people how to do the Grand Continental, which my guess means that they're going to be going back for the 2011 Festival Transamérique. They also have a bunch of other presentations and workshops happening there. But yes, we're out of time. As I said, prime time has shown up. Positive Vibes is up next. Marilyn, thank you very much. Alison Elizabeth, thank you very much. You make me sound and look and just be way better than I have any right to be. My name is Zeke. This has been Movement Museum on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on your cable dial, or movement-museum.blogspot.com on your computer or mobile device, and we will be back next week.
Do you want to dance?